This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, indeed, this is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we are back with you as we are every Friday at 9 o'clock, or just after news at 9. And today we have an unusual program in one sense. We usually do one guest at a time on a topic, but today, because two women wrote a book together, we're taking our chances that the electronics will hold, and we're going to have both of them as partners in our conversation. We have Tessa Dooms, I believe that's pronounced properly, and Lindsay Chutle. They co-authored a book entitled Colored Identity, How Classification Became Culture. And I don't want to read their full bios, although the bios are, in fact, very interesting. Lindsay grew up in El Dorado Park in Soweto in northern KZN. And she did a master's in journalism from Columbia University, no slouch school there, and international relations at the University of David Bautasran. I hope she wasn't one of my students. I don't know. I wonder.
No, I wasn't.
Well, I missed the pleasure. And the Mail and Guardian gave her the tick mark that said one of the 200 young South Africans in 2015. It also says, and I'm fascinated by this, she makes her own pasta, grows her own herbs, but can't keep orchids alive.
Yeah, I hate to say that the herbs have died as well. They were doing so well, and they've changed locations. The basil was really thriving.
And
the pasta,
gluten-free. Her partner in the book, Tessa Dooms, is now a director of the Rivonia Circle, and we'll get to that in a bit, I hope, to explain a little bit what that is. But she's done all kinds of things in development, administration. She's a sociologist, and she worked with the National Planning Commission, and she's a trustee of the Kahiso Trust, and she has a master's from the University of the Witwatersrand. And they're both joining us electronically, and so we're just going to hope that everything works today. This book, because I was particularly interested in the idea that was built right into its fabric, that identity of a group in South Africa started in a way on the basis of government instructions to classify people, but it became a culture, and the culture itself now is self-feeding or self-sustaining. Let me give you a couple of stories from my own circumstances. 30-some years ago, when we were living in Indonesia, in one of the main news magazines, there was a letter from a man in Cape Town published in the magazine. And he had written that he had a kris, which is a ritual sword, and a Quran, which had been handed down generation upon generation to him from the 1700s. And the inscription on the inside, written in the Arabic script, was from an exiled prince from the small islands of Ternate and Tidore in the eastern part of what is now Indonesia, what used to be one of the main area of the Spice Islands. And he was hoping somehow to connect up with what would have been his long ago family from eastern Indonesia, 300 years on. And the idea that he was reaching across generations and geography to somehow find relatives just absolutely intrigued me. I kept a copy of that letter with me for years, hoping that someday I would get back to South Africa and talk to him about it. And then by the time we got back here, we managed to lose the letter. So now I have no idea who he was and I can't reach him. A more successful version of this, my wife was able to reconstruct a lineage using inscriptions in a family Bible and then records in the mission station at Hunatendal to trace her own connections back to the late 1700s, which was rather more successful than almost anybody else I know, being able to figure out and find direct connections. And that speaks, I think, to the idea that culture was really important for people, even more than simple labels that government might have given. How did the two of you come to the idea that identity was an outgrowth of the government obsession with racial classification, and yet it was based on a whole range of things other than the simple genetics of the question, and deeply involved in the culture that people were bringing from various disparate parts of society and different ethnic groups as they came together to form what is now a somewhat cohesive group. Maybe we'll go alphabetically and we'll start with you, Tessa. What is your reaction?
Yeah, that's a really important thing about the book, is that we do focus in on the making of colored as a naming convention, as a label, as a classification, because of the history of the country. And also, the word itself has become fraught with that history and people struggle with it. But I'll let Lindsay speak to the use of the word colored before the apartheid moment itself, because of course, the apartheid government didn't invent the term colored, but it's the last and I think one of the most significant moments of, you know, making it a legal classification. But I tell a story about my father, who went to a classification office as a child, really, as a 16-year-old, taken from his high school with his classmates, without any parental supervision. And my father grew up in in an area called Ditakoneng, around the Freiburg area in the northwest. And he grew up in a Motswana community as a Motswana boy. And that's what my father knew himself as. And his family had, you know, a lot of different influences in terms of lineage and origin. But for him, his experience of growing up was as this Motswana boy. And when he goes to go and classify, you know, in the group areas or the population registration process, he enters into this room with this, you know, apartheid clerk. And the process of classification itself, I think we both explore in different parts of the book as something that already is a misnomer, because what my father gets classified as is not just based on how he appears and how he presents, because that is what the notion of race and in terms of biology is about. How do you present? How do you look? What are your features? Therefore, you are race X or race Y. But the classification process was also about asking very deeply cultural questions. What language do you speak? What is your name? What customs do you hold? And especially in the making of this classification of coloredness, there was an intention by government here to try and make or figure out what would distinguish colored people from other categories of black people in the country and native people in the country. But it was all very arbitrary and very much embedded in what they were looking for as cultural markers. So already at the classification moment, we're not just talking about biology. We're already talking about culture. But my father goes there and presents as he is, and his name, Lesole, which is a Motswana name for soldier, is the name that he gives, and he's classified as native Motswana. Goes home and realizes that my family, who has this mixed heritage of Tswana and German and all of that, had made a decision to classify as colored. And even again in that decision, we discovered as we've looked into histories in people in colored communities, that many colored families made those decisions quite actively, had to make decisions about what was going to be the thing that was going to keep their family together the most, or what was the thing that was going to give their children the most advantage in a society that was clearly oppressive. And so they'd made the decision to classify as colored, and then took him back and had him present with an English name. And that English name came to take away his Tswana name and replaced it wholesale in order to fit into apartheid's notions. But what the rest of the book does, because that moment is quite a violent moment of classification that takes away from my father a culture, literally. His Motswana-ness is taken away from him in that moment. I mean, the Group Areas Act takes that even further when he gets arrested and ends up having to live in a newly formed colored area, El Dorado Park. But what we talk about in the rest of the book is how these histories of slavery, colonialism, and apartheid actually lead to communities having to form and create new forms of culture, new norms, new values, new ways to be cohesive, despite not coming from the same origins. And despite being in a situation where a system was forcing people together, and from that, they created a community and a culture that we now see as coloredness.
We're going to take a quick station break and we'll be right back. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector and we're speaking with Tessa Dooms and Lindsay Chutle. And when we come back, we'll ask Lindsay to add into what was just said. Let's go to our break.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we're back again with co-authors Tessa Dooms and Lindsay Chutle. Tessa was speaking about their joint book, Colored, How Classification Became Culture. Book is just out, and we're going to let Lindsay add into what her co-author partner just said about the nature of culture creating ethnicity in a way. I should have also mentioned by introduction that Lindsay writes with the New York Times, which is no mean distinction either.
Thanks, Brooke. Oh, I should just say, my surname is pronounced Chutle. my grandfather was an immigrant from Malawi. He came as a minor and I'm sure he might have made the pronunciation up, but we honor his journey by keeping it.
I'm glad to be corrected. I hate mispronouncing a name.
It's a lifetime of mispronunciation, so not to worry. So I think the thing with what I liked about the process of the book particularly is I am a history geek, and so I spent quite a bit of time trying to dig through what life might have been like for colored people as the distinction came to be known, because it's a long process, you know, and it's a multifaceted process. It doesn't just happen in one go and then suddenly the word colored is used. But we know that because we see the word being used on the Caribbean, we know that it was used in the Jim Crow South. So this was clearly an international way of describing people who were black and brown, were not white, and people who were also of a certain labor class. And that's one of the first instances that we find in South Africa, is where Cecil John Rhodes at the time is looking for cheap labor on the newly formed diamond fields in South Africa. And he's looking around and he's like, well, you know, the natives might be a little bit obstinate and they might be difficult and they might try to take back their land, which would have been entirely acceptable. And so he decides that the best that they should be recruiting among the so-called colored people. Now, at the time, the colored people were a group of formerly enslaved people down at the Cape, but they were also the descendants of the Sun and the Khoi tribes who had barely survived the onslaught of Dutch and British colonialism, smallpox, wars, and it sort of like come together as a sort of disenfranchised refugee community. Then there was the community of the freed enslaved people. They were also mixed, because we often talk about slavery in terms of, particularly in South Africa, that it comes from Indonesia and Madagascar, but what that does is that it also overlooks the fact that so many people came from Angola and Mozambique and Ghana. And unfortunately, what that does is that it plays into a legacy of colorism that still exists in the colored community, where black ancestry is overlooked for Asian or white ancestry. And so for me, it's always important to remember the stories of the Africans who were brought to the Cape as well. So this group of people who were mixed at the time, who were not allowed to speak the language, most of them were forced to speak a creolized Dutch that became Afrikaans. And there were also people who had, you know, come freely, had come as migrants, because South Africa has always been, and unfortunately we seem to have forgotten that, is that South Africa is a country that has always attracted migrants for the last 400 or 500 years. And so these were also black and brown migrants who had come to the Cape. And so they were a mix of people, and they were people who had made a community out of disenfranchisement, out of loss. And they were a community just trying to make their way. And so the first time we hear the word colored is with Rhodes looks towards this group of mixed people and thinks, oh, well, here is a group that I can exploit. And we also see people starting to make a very deliberate decision where they ask to be classified as colored as opposed to native, purely for economic reasons, because they wanted a job in the diamond fields. And so it's the sort of the origins of the word, and it becomes the sort of like catch-all phrase for everybody who is not native. And it shows, and the complexity of that community at the time shows how complex, and it continues today, about how complex the identity of being colored is, and how many different groups, cultures, and histories form as well. I mean, for the longest time with my family is that I thought we were simply the descendants of Zulu people, Dutch and Germans, and that somehow ended up in KwaZulu-Natal. What I learned later is that we were in fact the descendants of enslaved people who had escaped from the Great Trek during what used to be called the Anglo-Boer War, the South African Civil War. and they were neither Zulu nor so-called native. And so they found themselves in this community and formed what became a little colored community in northern KZN. So it's a complex phrase. And what I hope the book does is that it tries to capture all our stories, tries to capture the many different wonderful ways of being colored. Because I think sometimes also when we look for a culture, we try and find very distinct markers. And what we want people to say is that there is no one way of being colored.
Intrigued by the one chapter in the book, which I think a lot of people will scratch their heads over, why Trevor Noah is not colored. I'm fascinated by it for one reason among many. I met somebody some years ago. It was a black South African guest lecturer in an American university. And when he was explaining the racial circumstances of South Africa, and he got to the word colored, one of his students put up his or her hand and said, "Excuse me, which parent is black and which parent is white?" It wasn't a comment that was opprobrious, but it was a mystification of the nature of the thing. And that leads to the idea, a new term, well, not new, but a term which has taken on more currency now, mixed race as opposed to color. There's somehow some kind of distinction being made there. Tessa, you're nodding your head. I can see on our computer screen, and you're ready to tell me something about this. I can see.
Yeah. So I want to pick this up actually where Lindsay left off in terms of people being classified as colored as opposed to native. And I often say to people about this book, one of the things that I get to understand in writing this book is how destructive apartheid colonialism and slavery have been to the Khoi and San people of this country and their descendants, because they in fact, you know, are native people. And so when the apartheid government particularly says you're colored, not native, it assumes a lot of things. It assumes that in order to be colored, or to, when you talk about colored people, you're talking about people who are a mix between something and something else, someone and someone else, and particularly someone who is not African, somebody who is European, somebody who's not from the continent. And that's part of the story that we have to actually break, is that being colored is not about not being native or African or not being fully black. Being colored is about a cultural experience from a community that has formed in the face of slavery, colonialism, and apartheid. So how does this link into the story of Trevor Noah? I do not take lightly, and I wrote that chapter, so I have to own up to it. I never take lightly talking about somebody else's identity, but Trevor Noah has done a good job of talking about his own identity and giving us a good insight into his background. And one of the things that is clear about his background is that he's somebody who has a father who is Swiss and white, would be considered white racially, and a mother who is black and Xhosa, and is raised in Soweto. And so he is from a mixed heritage in a number of different ways. But none of that mixed heritage, just because it is mixed, equates to having grown up and lived the experience of a colored person in contemporary South Africa. And that's the point that we make in the chapter, is that to be colored, especially in the last 70 odd years or so, post the Group Areas Act particularly, where colored communities as a geographic and cultural communities really solidify, that's a unique set of experiences and a unique set of norms and values and food and ideas and hair and clothing that simply does not translate if you are not raised in those kinds of communities, in these communities. And that's the thing that we are calling colored identity and colored as a culture.
You'd say it's all those things, not necessarily the gene pool.
Yes, it's not the gene pool. Because, you know, the gene pool was used in weird ways to classify people, but it's what came from those classifications in terms of the life that people needed to make for themselves that makes one colored. So I often say to people, I can tell that people are colored even without having had extensive conversations with them, because people show up in particular ways in colored communities, as they do in other communities in the country. There are particular ways of dressing, particular food, particular, even just mannerisms that colored communities have. And I've seen it, especially as we've been doing this book, across communities. I was in KZN recently, both in Wentworth and in Newlands East, two well-known colored communities there. And as we were telling stories, I mean, the story of the Cook sister, the story of songs and religion, people could relate to me, even though I'm from El Dorado Park, people could relate to stories about colored communities in Cape Town, because there is a cultural aspect of coloredness that we've created, that we've borrowed each other culture as we've tried to merge into a singular community. And so what we say in that chapter very explicitly is that not all colored people are colored because of a mixed heritage of a European ancestor and a black ancestor. That's just not how all people come to be colored. Some people come to be colored, like I said, through Khoi and San ancestry and the decision to classify those people under coloredness. Some people come because of Malay slave ancestry that may have nothing to do with European ancestors in their line. But people come to it differently. And more importantly, for our current generation of colored people, particularly people of my generation and younger, I don't have a black mother and a white father. And most colored people in these generations don't have that. We're not mixed race. We are colored by culture. And it's not an indictment against Trevor Noah that he's not. It's just an explanation that this is not about a mixed race identity. It's about a cultural community that has formed despite the disruptions of colonialism and apartheid.
We're going to have to take another station break and some commercial messages. And we're speaking with Tessa Dooms and Lindsay Schutel. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and my guests this morning, Lindsay Schutel and Tessa Dooms, are the co-authors of a new book, Colored, How Classification Became Culture. And we were talking about Trevor Noah and the question of colored versus mixed race. I just want to pose a question for you about that. Somebody like Mark Lottering. Mark Lottering is very clearly of the community, embraces it in his comedy in a way that Trevor Noah perhaps can't. Does that seem fair to you, Tessa?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think Trevor Noah has flirted with this quite a bit in his comedy. I remember I reference in the book his very first one-man show, Daywalker, where he speaks about, you know, his mother's need and attempts to kind of explain him away to the community and to the authorities, and him then having to also explain himself in his community and finding that children in Soweto who didn't look like him, he was of a lighter hue, I guess, calling him an albino or saying he has albinism as like a way to try and figure out who he is. And him not having the language, you know, to say, you know, I'm colored, because that's not the cultural experience that he had. And so I think that he's flirted with it in a way that I think he shows that colored communities may look to him and wonder, you know, is he colored? But he doesn't have the cultural experience. And Mark Lottering speaks to that cultural experience or uses his comedy to explain the cultural experience. You know that Mark Lottering is colored because he can talk, when he talks about the life circumstances that he knows and context that he understands best, he's talking about all of the both stereotypical and unspoken norms and ideas around coloredness, and he knows that as a lived experience. And Trevor Noah doesn't have that lived experience because it's just not, you know, the one that he has. And I think that's a really good comparison.
For both of you, I realize in a book that's a slender volume, it's only 178 pages once you subtract the introduction and the thank you notes at the end and a few other bits and pieces, and you can't cover every topic in it all, let alone in detail. But there were three things that struck me, maybe four, which could have used even more elaboration and discussion. And one was the question of music, and I looked for and was hoping to find, but didn't see in much depth, somebody like Talib Peterson and his partnership with David Kremer in exploring the identity through a variety of musicals and other works, and then Kremer doing it afterwards, even after Talib had died, in education. I would have enjoyed reading more about the impact of a fairly select number of high schools, which were in the time certainly entirely comprised of colored students, places like Harold Cressy or Trafalgar in the Cape Town area, and eventually the creation of a political feeling at the University of the Western Cape. And then further back in history, the identity forming elements that may have come about during World War II service among men who joined the Cape Corps, which I think was an important element in creating identity. Then the political movement that sprang up, I guess, right at the beginning of the actual apartheid era, the New Unity Movement and the Teachers League and things like that. But then also writers, Richard Reeve or Peter Clark or Adam Small, in shaping the way in which an identity was described, because their books were read by many more people than just members of their own community. I realize that's a very ambitious agenda for the next few minutes, but Tessa, take a whack at it, and Lindsay, if you want to chime in as well.
No, I'm actually going to ask Lindsay to start off with this one, because a few of those things, especially on the historical side, I know of her particular interest, so I'll let her start.
Okay, Lindsay, go ahead.
Oh yeah, I mean, so when we went through and we were trying to discuss about how exactly we would tell these stories, because also, for example, in the political chapter, so we talk about the APO quite a bit, the African Political Organization, and Sisi Gul and Abdul Rahman. I must be forgetting his name, but what we go through, we might have. And I had the background on that, but then there was a very deliberate conversation, and we had this conversation particularly about Adam Small. And I said, you know, Tessa, someone's going to come back and ask us why we didn't write about Adam Small. And the reason, and we had this discussion and we thought, well, one of the most important things for us is because, you know, there has been a really fantastic book written about the political history of colored people from before slavery. And so what we were trying to do is not to rehash what was already out there. And then also what we wanted to do was very deliberately write a story about ordinary people. So you'll notice that, apart from Trevor Noah, everybody else in the book is an unknown or so-called unknown. Like these, and also we don't even focus on the story of Trevor Noah. We focus on people who are not well-known, stories that are everyday stories. And that was a very deliberate choice on our part, because for one, we wanted to talk about the breadth of the colored experience. Talib Peterson and the legacy of Guma, and also, for example, the fact that Manenberg is quite frankly an anthem of our people that we all know quite well. But what's happened is, and it's a conversation that we keep having, is that coloredness has been limited to an idea around the Western Cape. And in the Western Cape is a very particular cultural expression of colored identity, because it's also it's a large population group. Whereas what we tried to deliberately do was to write about people who had an experience all the way up until Limpopo and how colored identity was formed in those parts. And so what we did was we found the stories of everyday people who might have been forgotten and whose lived experiences are whispered at the dinner table. They sort of become family lore, or, you know, in many cases, they're simply not spoken about. And so that was how we wanted to approach that. And that's how this is why the book is formed and shaped in the way that it is. This is why so many of the people on the cover, those are in fact not stock photos. They are real people. And so that's what we mentioned. I mean, I was thinking particularly on the, if we do get to do a second edition, and I hope Jonathan Bourne is listening, we'd love to go back into, there's a couple of things that we also thought afterward we'd have liked to focus more on. The point of colored schools as well. For example, where my family grew up in KwaZulu-Natal, there was just one school that you could go to. It was two, Iklopo, and then in Harding. My family, my mum and her siblings all went to boarding school because there were no schools for colored children. And so that created an entirely different sensibility around respectability politics and what it meant to be colored in KwaZulu-Natal. And that's not an experience that has seen much of the light of day. And then the other thing we wanted to talk about, hopefully in this second edition that you've now convinced Jonathan Ball to do, Brooks, is perhaps you can talk about the making of names in colored identity and how, you know, we've it draws very much on the African-American experience of creating a new identity, of taking names from television, taking names from pop culture. And I know Mark Lottring makes a difference of this, and that's how you know the colored experience is almost universal across South Africa, because the jokes Mark Lottring makes are the jokes that are made across the country, and those little hints and whispers. So that's why we did that. And we're, you know, happy to talk more about Adam Small and Tilly Peterson, but we also wanted to talk about ordinary people.
What you did in one of the chapters, there is a brief mention of Chris Van Wyk. For many people who have read one or more of his books, whether they're the children's books or the Long Walk to Freedom and the Child's Edition as adapted by him, or in his two memoirs, let alone all his poetic works and some criticism, Chris began for a lot of people to be the voice of his generation, of his community, because he was talking to the common experiences as seen through a child's eye. And if you do a second edition, I hope you'll amplify that even more than Adam Small, but perhaps the whole collection of Richard Reeve and Peter Clark and Small and Bessie Head and Chris Van Wyk deserve more attention or examination. And even, and I'll just toss this out, probably more controversial because she obviously was not from that community, Sarah Gertrude Millen and God's Stepchildren, which is the first work which really speaks to the community, but not in a particularly pleasant or comfortable or even favorable, let alone, well, actually disparaging kind of way. And this collection of writers, I think, gives a sense of the varieties of experience, perspectives. And I hope that if you do version two, you'll include some of this discussion, not in an arcane kind of literary analysis, but in a seeing through the eyes of quote unquote normal people. How do they react to these literatures?
For me, Chris Van Wyk was shaped quite a bit of how I thought about how to write the politics chapter. His autobiography, Shirley, Goodness and Mercy, spoke about very much very similar experience of growing up in Johannesburg, growing up in Rivoli, and he has this beautiful, inclusive his poetry growing up on it. And he has this really great understanding of what I loved about his was an acknowledgement of coming to his politics and an acknowledgement that to coming to understand that he was in fact a black man. And it's been an experience for both Chris and I, and we've said this quite often, is that, you know, culturally we are colored, but politically we are black. And Chris Van Wyk's Shirley, Goodness and Mercy tells that journey beautifully. And so if we do get another edition, I'd love to write on that. But more than that, I think, you know, anybody who wants to explore colored identity should definitely go and read that one. But I like that. But I think the idea of including Bessie Head in that is so interesting, right? Because I'm not clear that Bessie Head ever called herself colored. Bessie Head was put into an orphanage of mixed race children. And I interviewed a woman who was in the same orphanage she was put in because she had a Zulu father, a Zulu mother and an Indian father. And, she was taken away from her family, by social workers and forced to go into this orphanage in Durban. Bessie Head, also a formative African writer, particularly as a woman who's not given enough due, not just for Maru, but for When Rain Clouds Gather. But my question then is, do we see Bessie Head as a colored writer? I have honestly never considered her a colored writer. I considered her a Botswana writer, even though she wasn't from Botswana. She wrote so beautifully about the country. I think that's the power of literature. So, you know, and I have a friend, for example, who's Somali, who holds onto Peter Clark so deeply, who grew up on Peter Clark in a way that I, quite frankly, did not, you know. And so when we think about what makes coloredness and we think about these cultural markers, it's also so tricky. And we think about it as in a sort of a post-apartheid way, what makes coloredness and what makes that identity? Because I think the thing that our first question that we asked ourselves was, we both, Chris and I both came to the realization that we thought that children born after apartheid would no longer use the term, and yet they still are. And not only are they doing it with the greatest sense of pride even, and they're sort of reclaiming the word. So I want to throw back to Chris on just what that reclamation means and why the book so deliberately looks at the past, but more looks towards the future.
Chessa, before you chime in here, I'm going to have to take a station break because these are the things one has to do. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're having a conversation with co-authors Lindsay Schutel and Tessa Dooms, whose new book out is, very straightforwardly, Colored: How Classification Became Culture. published by Jonathan Ball. We have to give the publishers their acknowledgement too, don't we? We'll be right back after this message.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we're in conversation with Lindsay Schutel and Tessa Dooms, co-authors of their new book, Colored, How Classification Became Culture. And we were just, I actually interrupted Tessa. She was just about to chime in, and I said, we got to go to a station break. But here it is. You're back.
I think one of the points, and this links also to the Trevor Noah chapter, because I actually make the argument there, is around this being about a process of not reclaiming the word colored per se, but reclaiming colored people and people who associate with that identity's right to self-identify. I mean, apartheid slavery, our history has taken away people's agency of self-identification. And so when we say that we are culturally colored, we also recognize that many people who had been given that identity label by, you know, different forms of oppression may reject that. I mean, we've encountered a lot of people who say, you know, that's a label that was given by the apartheid government or by slave owners. We reject it. And I think that they have a legitimate right to do that.
This may sound a little bit dangerous, perhaps, but I've been thinking about the question of color, colored people, politics, and because we're now in the sort of the anniversary moment of the United Democratic Front, I thought about it for a while, and I realized many of the key figures in that movement started, what, 40 years ago, would be classified as colored. Reverend Alan Busack, Trevor Manuel, Gerald Carolus, those are all people who are not African in the old accepted meaning of the word. Do you see an explanation or a reason why that would be true? How did such a thing come about? Or am I overstating a circumstance? I'm asking Lindsay about the ethnicity, if you will, of the leadership of the United Democratic Front in its formation and rolling off a list of names, Alan Busack and Trevor Manuel and Cheryl Carolus. Those are people who would be, obviously were, classified as colored. And if you think of Chris Van Veke, he always put the quotation marks around the word with his fingers in the air. And it was sort of a piquant thing to see when he did that in a conversation with him. He put both hands up, say the word, and put two quotation marks. Speak to me a little bit about this, because we're running up against time soon. The nature of political engagement in that period, the 1980s and early 90s, and on into our current circumstances.
Okay, I'll answer quickly on the UDF and interrupt Tessa on this one, but I think what the United Democratic Front did, what it did, particularly for colored people, was because it was based on the ideology of black consciousness and black consciousness as a political identity. And what it did was then is that it created a framework for us to understand how to use the language to show and explain our oppression and our shared oppression. Because what the apartheid government did very successfully was to create the idea that there was a vast difference in the way that they oppressed people. And we know that the difference was not, in fact, that vast. It might have been 2 cents more spent on a colored child than on a black child. There was still a sense of oppression. And what we look at is, and particularly when we think of black oppression in the way W.E.B. Du Bois puts it, is that there is a universal experience of what it means to be black. And so what the Black Consciousness Movement did, and then the leaders of the UDF did, was to put colored identity and colored struggles as a national struggle. I think in thinking about it, because the Black Consciousness Movement laid my identity as well, but I think what it did was, is that it had a single villain and a single enemy. And so the struggle in some sense was almost more violent, but it was simpler. But what I do think with the Black Consciousness Movement does not have right now is the language and the tools to deal with systemic racism, to deal with systemic oppression that we're still dealing with in the post-apartheid South Africa. And in the post-colonial world across the world, I think there's a reason identity politics exists, because we are all beginning to deeply understand our intersectionality and to understand that we are not just black. We have a cultural identity. We have a gendered identity. And so I think it's not a rejection of the Black Consciousness Movement. It's asking for it to make space for intersectionality. And so while we're grateful to the leaders of the United Democratic Front I spoke to Sheila Cronus for this book, and she was really, she guided me on this. But I also think that it is up to a new generation to pick up the baton. And this is where I'll throw back to Tissa in explaining why millennials still use this word.
That's when we lost Tessa briefly, and she was sort of right there at that moment. And please go ahead.
For me, our generation, so myself and Lindsay, born in the 80s, and then now a generation after us, my nieces and nephews, we grew up being raised in this cultural community, that is the colored community. And in the same way that no one in South Africa would ever say to a Xhosa person, you cannot call yourself black and Xhosa. We contend that you should not be able to say to a colored person, you cannot call yourself black and colored. Because, as Lindsay has pointed out, black, as we know through our consciousness and through our political education, is that black is about a common struggle against white supremacy and racism, common struggle against oppression, and a common struggle against the use of, you know, biology and phenotypes to use to find a justification for whiteness to oppress somebody else. So blackness is about that shared struggle, and we can have that shared struggle and still have different experiences in the world, like being colored. And my experience about my cultural norms and values comes from, you know, that grouping of society. And I don't feel like I need to reject that. So when people say to me, you have to reject the word colored because it comes from this colonial past, I'm like, I can reject the word, but I'm still left with the culture. And so until I have a different naming convention for this cultural experience that I have as this generation of person, the word colored is still the thing that most clearly explains the identity, the cultural identity that I hold. And even more so, I spent a lot of time, Lindsay spent a lot of time digging into history for this, and I spent a lot of time talking to young people. And as I spoke to young people for this book, they expressed a similar sentiment that coloredness for them is a core part of how they understand themselves in the world and see themselves in the world. And they don't have the same relationship with it of the kind of violence that we know is associated with the term. And so another part of reclamation that we call for in this book is for us to give younger generations of people the opportunity to redefine what it means to be colored for them. The opportunity to show us what it can look like going into the future. The opportunity for us to reclaim not only our right to self-identify, but also the role we want to play in South Africa and our legitimacy to play that role. And I think if we deny young people the opportunity to identify and to create new meaning to this identity today, they will deny us, you know, the legitimacy of the histories that we try to impose on them. And so we do ask for that kind of grace. And I think that's a good place for us to end, is it's a call for empathy and understanding in the complexity of identity.
Unfortunately, where time is against us, and I would love to continue this with a 2 or 3 hour conversation, but we really do have to make way for the next program. We've been speaking with Tessa Dooms and Lindsay Schutel, who are the co-authors of their new book, Colored, subtitled How Classification Became Culture. I'm holding a copy of it because I have just read it. But in this book, I have to ask one last question. Somebody can answer it in 10 seconds. The term seven-color meal mystified me. I didn't know what it was. You have 5 seconds to explain it.
Go, Lindsay.
It's a good plate on a Sunday afternoon, and you know it's good because every food has a different color. Green for spinach, red for beetroot, orange for dal, white for rice. And so you know you're eating well when you have a colorful plate.
Well, that's explained, because I even asked my wife, and we got into a discussion over this, and we couldn't quite identify all the colors. We couldn't figure out what purple was.
That would be a good red cabbage. Beetroot or a good red cabbage post 2010.
Good enough. Okay. Now that question has been solved for all time. Okay. This is Brooke Spector. This is The Deep Dive, and we've had this wonderful moment to speak to two co-authors for their new book, which is available in bookstores now. Lindsay Schutel and Tessa Dooms, thanks very much for sharing your time with us. This is The Deep Dive, and we'll be back again next week with another conversation of interest and importance on another aspect of life in South Africa or the world.